This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Adam Summers spent his childhood in the concrete jungle of downtown Manhattan. But the city's green parks and yearly trips to the woods and streams of Canada turned him into an outdoorsman with a particular passion for marine life. Today, he's more than a fish enthusiast. He is a comparative biomechanist and an expert on marine evolution, anatomy, and movement. Adam has consulted with Pixar on animated films Finding Nemo and Finding Dory, and he leads a new initiative to scan and digitize 33,000 species of fish. Adam is also a professor at the University of Washington and a visiting professor at Duke University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Adam Summers, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thanks very much for having me, Frank.
Take us back now. Tell us how this passion for fish began.
Well, like you said, I grew up in downtown Manhattan in Greenwich Village, and I was always a fish guy. I think I had my first aquarium when I was 5 or 6. I loved fish. I worked in pet stores before you could work for money, you know, 10, 12, 13 years old. And I spent my summers in the North Woods of Canada fly fishing and trolling for lake fish. And so I built fly rods and tied flies and, in general, did everything I could to interact with fish.
What was it about them, you think?
I think they're magical. They do something that I love to do, which is move in 3 dimensions. I'm also a pilot. And so for me, looking at them moving through the water and hovering and then you know, sort of maneuvering around the underwater realm was just hypnotic. And then when I'd pull them out of the water and manipulate their fins and sort of feel their scales, I was just blown away by how beautifully complex they were. And so, I mean, I didn't think it was a job, right? I mean, I thought it was at best sort of a weekend hobby. And so when I was an undergraduate, I never studied biology. I studied math and engineering. And it wasn't until much, much later that I became a biologist and got my first taste of actually fishing, like with big nets and things. I realized I don't like fishing per se. I like the fish. I like to see them come up. And so I've completely abandoned rods and reels and all I do is I scuba dive and I haul fish out of the water in big nets or catch them in tricky gill nets and things.
Well, it also has the virtue of, if you want to really just specialize, you can be called an ichthyologist.
Exactly.
I was not as interested in fish, but I always wanted to be called that.
Really?
So, yeah. Wouldn't it be cool to then have to tell everybody what the heck that was?
Yeah. You know? You do. You get to explain the wonders of ichthyology.
But it's more than that for you, and it's biomechanics of fish, as you described earlier. And there was a moment for you that had to do with the cling fish and a problem that you were trying to solve simultaneously. That was quite a revelation for you.
Right. So this is not early in my career. This is middle of my career. I've spent most of my academic career gathering data at a little research station at the University of Washington called the Friday Harbor Laboratories. And so while I was a graduate student, while I was a postdoc at Berkeley, and eventually as a professor at UC Irvine, I was always going up there. And I had this routine. I love walking through the intertidal, flipping rocks. You find fish right under the rocks. You flip a rock, and there's a fish under there, little eely-like things called gunnels and stuff. But there's also a really cool fish called the clingfish. You'd flip a rock and you'd see this tadpole-looking fish with a little bandit mask across his eyes stuck to the rocks. And I would pry one of these off the rocks and I'd look around at who was nearby and I'd say, hey, you want to see a fish? And I'd clap it onto their forehead where it would stick. And there it would be stuck to their face. And it was stuck so firmly that I often got a photograph. And so I have many, many photographs of my friends
nose?
And
I mean,
colleagues, you know, going, ah! And there's a fish, you know, attached to their face. And I have to say that it was a solid 10 years of doing this. Until one morning, I was walking in the intertidal, flipped a rock, and tried to pry one off the rock and eventually did. And I realized, I can't buy a suction cup that would attach to this rock. I mean, this is a typical intertidal rock. It's really rough. It's covered with marine snot, algae, invertebrates. It's disgusting. And this thing is attached to it completely, so hard that you think you're going to hurt the fish pulling it off. I thought, I can't buy a suction cup like that. There has to be something really cool here that allows them to stick. And so that then determined the sort of course of the laboratory for 4 or 5 years. We basically worked on how they stick and how well they stick to different things. We figured out that they stick to really rough surfaces, like the sandpaper that you use to remove varnish from a wooden floor, that really rough 43 grit sandpaper. They stick to it as well as they stick to 1,000 grit sandpaper. The only stuff they don't stick that well to is glass.
Hmm.
So they stick less well to the smooth surface that your commercial suction cup sticks to, and better to everything else. And this is when they're dead. So a dead clingfish sticks. So it's purely a mechanical property of the disc. It's not something tricky that the clingfish has figured out how to do. It's a shape thing. It's a morphology thing. And that's my wheelhouse. I was just absolutely delighted by this.
What is it? What is it? They've got little hairs that stick into the holes? Or what's going on?
You're right on it. Right?
All right.
So if you look at the edge of a clingfish disc, first of all, the clingfish disc is super soft.
The disc is the...
The disc is the suction part, right?
Okay.
It's this big disc on the belly about the size of a quarter on a fish the size of your index finger.
And just to hold it right there, so you would look at that, and because of our experience with suction cups and glass, we assume that it's using the same principle because
yep.
it kind of looks a little the same. It's just going to press in. There's going to be vacuum. It's going to hold. And then you realize, well, it can't be.
Right. So you look at it and you say, that doesn't look like a suction cup that should work.
No.
First of all, a good commercial suction cup is quite stiff. This is really soft and easily manipulated, but also it's covered with little lumps. And suction cups shouldn't have little lumps. They should be dead smooth. And this isn't. When you put it on the scanning electron microscope, each of those little lumps is covered in tiny hairs. And those hairs are the same size, the same length, and the same width as the hairs that you find on gecko's toes. And I mean, it's one of the great biomechanical, biomimetic stories of all time, the gecko's toes, which are using dry adhesion, van der Waals forces to attach to things. Obviously, in the marine environment underwater, you're not using anything called dry adhesion.
Right.
And these, in fact, don't, in the end, look much like gecko hairs. They're the same size, but they're really soft and limp and spaghetti-like instead of being stiff and like spatulas. What we figured out was going on was that these little lumps were actually increasing friction. And so a normal suction cup, when you pull on it and it fails, when you pull, the edges of the cup sneak inwards. And they're pulled inwards and they're pulled inwards. And that decreases the circumference of the cup. So the cup's material is jammed into a smaller space.
Mm-hmm.
That's compression. So the stuff in the edge of the disc is in compression. And eventually, when it fails by compressive buckling. And a little bleb forms and water rushes under the cup. That doesn't happen in the clingfish because the edges have so much friction that they won't move in. And so instead, they fail the way... In peel, the way a piece of tape might. You take a piece of tape and tape it down to a desk and then pull it at a very low angle. And it's really good at resisting movement and resisting. And then suddenly it'll go pop.
Mm-hmm.
And so that turns out to be how these cups are failing.
Well, so and these hairs are sort of finding these little crevices,
exactly.
These tiny little holes. They're getting a little bit of a lock, creating a little friction. So this is what you can learn. You have a project now that I'd like you to tell us about, which is to do CAT scans on every species of fish available, right?
This is true. And for those of you listening who do Twitter, you can go and look at my Twitter feed or actually more usefully look at the hashtag #ScanAllFish. This came about because we got private donations to get a CT scanner in the lab, and I'd been scanning fish to look at their skeletons for 20 years. 20 years I'd done maybe as many as 600 species of fish. We got a scanner, and I started working on armored fishes, and I started putting up pictures, and I would put them on Twitter, and people would say, "Wow, that's really pretty. What's the next fish you're going to do?" And I would sort of facetiously say, "We're doing them all next. This is, we're going to scan every fish." But there's 33,000 species of fish. So my tongue was pretty firmly in my cheek at, 5-6 hours a scan. That was not going to happen while I was actually breathing in and out. So what happened was, having that scanner there, I started messing around with interesting techniques. First of all, I realized you didn't want super high resolution because you couldn't load it in a computer. You wanted a particular resolution. And then I realized, wow, if you pile the fish into a burrito, you can scan 20 or 25 of them at the same time.
And have a great lunch.
Yeah. Well, we worked with museum specimens, which are fixed in formalin and then stuck in ethanol. So lunch is really a matter of taste, right? I mean, maybe some people would like to eat them, but I definitely don't. So we've got all these fish burritos now, and we're able to scan 80 species a day. So we're already over 1,800 species, and we are. We're going to scan every single species of fish, and we put them up on the web for anyone to use for any purpose. They're right up there, Creative Commons by attribution. Yeah. You can make a living off them. More power to you.
So initially, I think the interest was probably in how just gorgeous they are and amazing and exotic. But what can we learn from seeing all this and getting CAT scans in particular?
Yeah, so my interest at the time I started was really specific. I was interested in a group of armored fishes, and I was trying to figure out new ways to make a biomimetic armor. And so I was scanning 60 or so species of armored fishes. But what we've found is that by opening up the scanner, anyone can come and scan fishes for free. We've had data sets go up that are inspirational to people who are completely not associated with the original scanning of them. I'll give you an example. We were just trying to do some diversity and scanned a piranha. The typical thing that shows up in the Attenborough series where they eat an entire cow in 5 minutes, a big school of them.
Yeah.
And I scanned this thing and I looked at the ribs, and two of the ribs are perfectly bisected, like with wire cutters. And there's a chunk missing, and then the bottom edges of the ribs have grown together, very strange looking. And I was looking at that going, I've never seen anything like that in a fish. What could have done that? And I realized I'm looking at what could have done it. These are schooling fish. They live in high-density schools, and when fish live in schools, they chat with each other. They chat with each other by moving their body. They chat with each other by flicking each other with their fins. And they chat with each other by nipping each other. And what I was looking at was evidence of a pretty good nip in the side that had just clipped a chunk out of this fish. Mm-hmm. And the moment I saw that, I realized, wow, the bigger the school, the more dense the school, the more damage the fish can do to one another. And then I realized what I was looking at on their belly. They have this armored keel down the belly. I thought, this seems like it's actually there to prevent a discussion from turning into someone's guts all over the Amazon.
Or friendly fire. Just in the middle of a frenzy, you get bitten by mistake, by accident.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So right now what we're doing is we're scanning, I think we've got 40 species of fish. This is with Matt Coleman at the labs. And he's plotting with a German woman named Paulina Urban. He's plotting the density of the school against the size of that keel to see if he can show that the more fish you have in the school, the more reinforced your keel is, which is we would then take as good evidence that the keel has something to do with defense.
But otherwise, we might have just assumed it was a defense against other species, which it could be. But if you can make this correlation, then you say, wait a minute, they've already figured out through, yep, you know, millennia of evolution, friendly fire is a danger to piranha. So you consulted for Pixar, right? Finding Nemo and Finding Dory? What'd you do?
I did. This is now a very long time ago, right? So I'm dining out on things that happened 20 years ago nearly. When I was a postdoc, my landlady was in charge of Pixar University. In fact, she isn't my landlady anymore, but Elise is still in charge of Pixar University. And she came down to our apartment and asked me if I knew anyone who knew anything about fish. And I said, yeah, I do. I know something about fish. And she then asked me if I could give a short lecture, an hour lecture about fish to some people. And I said, sure, because the truth is I can talk for an arbitrary length of time about fish to any audience at all. It always entertains me. It may not entertain them. Well, what was meant to be an hour turned into 3 hours of Q&A on fishes. And that turned into working on Finding Nemo for 3 years as sort of a fact checker and a recruiter. So there's lots of things I don't know much about biologically. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, you know, how does water move? And I'd say, I know a guy or I know a woman. And we would go off and find the world expert in for instance, movement of seaweeds. And so this...
That's amazing that that much research went into this.
Yes.
Were you at a point where you'd look at something, you know, you'd look at a take and say, no, the fish, he could never do that. No fish could do that.
Oh yeah.
That kind of thing?
I mean, this happened all the time. We would have... You can't call them fights. I mean, just, we would discuss the science and how close to reality it is. And you have to... There's lots and lots of things that aren't right. I would point out problems. One of the early questions was, where are the eyebrows on a fish? Because they're not obvious. Where are the eyebrows exactly? And I said, well, it's good that you hired me because I can give you a fact right off the bat. I can tell you a truth. And the truth is that fish don't have eyebrows. They have no eyebrows at all. In fact, they have no muscles of facial expression. They can't smile. They can't wink. None of that stuff. And they looked at me and they said, our fish are going to have eyebrows. And I said, no. Fish, definitely not. They said, no, you don't understand. Fish don't talk.
Oh, my God.
It could be a real bad movie if fish don't talk.
Throw you out
so
of your ear.
We need eyebrows. And so then we would go over to the – we went over to the Cal Academy, and we took every character out of the jar and sat there and played with the fish until we found places where you could plausibly put muscles of facial expression and plausibly put eyebrows. And that allows them to act. Well, you don't have to do that, right? This was a decision that Pixar made that cost them money. It cost them time. But it adds so much to the gravitas of the film when you look at it and your whole being says, yeah, that's pretty close to a fish. I mean, it's a talking fish, and I know they don't talk, but that really is a Moorish idol. That really is a puffer fish. And if instead you make everyone do the same thing, well, then all the characters might as well be one species of fish. You know, why bother?
And then you've got an Adam Sandler movie.
Yes, exactly.
Adam Summers is with us on The State of Things. Check out his Twitter feed. He's got he's scanning the fish, and there are some amazing sites there. I tell you what, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, to find out more. Adam Summers, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.